ridiculous extremes. A map of a province was so detailed that it was the size of an entire city. The map of the empire occupied an entire province. In time, the cartographers became even more ambitious. They drew a map that was an exact one-to-one replica of the whole empire. As Borges wryly notes, subsequent generations could find no practical use for such an unwieldy map, so the map was left to rot in the desert, along with the science of geography that it represented. Borges's point still eludes many social scientists today. Understanding requires simplification and abstraction from many real-world details. The best way to respond to the complexity of social life is not to devise ever more elaborate models, but to learn how different causal mechanisms work, one at a time, and then figure out which ones are most relevant in a particular setting. We use one map if we are driving from home to work, and another one if we are traveling to another city. Yet other kinds of maps are needed if we are on a bike, on foot, or planning to take public transport. Navigating among economic models, choosing which one will work better, is considerably more difficult than choosing the right map. Practitioners use a variety of formal and informal empirical methods with varying skill. And in my book, Economics Rules, I criticize economics training for not properly equipping students for the empirical diagnostics that the discipline requires. But the profession's internal critics are wrong to claim that the discipline has gone wrong because economists have yet to reach consensus on the correct models, their preferred ones, of course. Let us cherish economics in all its diversity, rational and behavioral, Keynesian and classical, first best and second best, orthodox and heterodox, and devote our energy to becoming wiser at picking which framework to apply when. It is only when we maintain a healthy diversity of frameworks that we can understand some of the key problems of our time. Consider two issues rife with important policy challenges: inequality and the effects of technology and innovation. Good and bad inequality. In the pantheon of economic theories, the trade-off between equality and efficiency used to occupy an exalted position. The American economist Arthur Oaken, whose classic work on the topic is called Equality and Efficiency, The Big Trade-Off, believed that public policies revolved around managing the tension between those two values. As recently as 2007, when New York University economist Thomas Sargent, addressing the graduating class at the University of California, Berkeley, summarized the wisdom of economics in 12 short principles, the trade-off was among them. The belief that boosting equality requires sacrificing economic efficiency is grounded in one of the most cherished ideas in economics: incentives. Firms and individuals need the prospect of higher incomes to save, invest, work hard, and innovate. If taxation of profitable firms and rich households blunts those prospects, the result is reduced effort and lower economic growth. Communist countries, where egalitarian experiments led to economic disaster, long served as Exhibit A in the case against redistributive policies. In recent years, however, neither economic theory nor empirical evidence has been kind to the presumed trade-off. Economists have produced new arguments showing why good economic performance is not only compatible with distributive fairness, but may even demand it. For example, in high-inequality societies, where poor households are deprived of economic and educational opportunities, economic growth is depressed. Then there are the Scandinavian countries, where egalitarian policies evidently have not stood in the way of economic prosperity. In 2014, economists at the International Monetary Fund produced empirical results that seemed to upend the old consensus. They found that greater equality is associated with faster subsequent medium-term growth, both across and within countries. Moreover, redistributive policies did not appear to have any detrimental effects on economic performance. We can have our cake, it seems, and eat it too. That is a striking result, all the more so because it comes from the IMF, an institution hardly known for heterodox or radical ideas. Economics is a science that can claim to have uncovered few, if any, universal truths. Like almost everything else in social life, the relationship between equality and economic performance is likely to be contingent rather than fixed, depending on the deeper causes of inequality and many mediating factors. So the emerging new consensus on the harmful effects of inequality is as likely to mislead as the old one was. Consider, for example, the relationship between industrialization and inequality. In a poor country where the bulk of the workforce is employed in traditional agriculture, the rise of urban industrial opportunities is likely to produce inequality, at least during the early stages of industrialization. As farmers move to cities and earn higher pay, income gaps open up. And yet, this is the same process that produces economic growth. All successful developing countries have gone through it. In China, rapid economic growth after the late 1970s was associated with a significant rise in inequality. Roughly half of the increase was the result of urban-rural earnings gaps, which also acted as the engine of growth. Or consider transfer policies that tax the rich and the middle classes in order to increase the income of poor households. Many countries in Latin America, such as Mexico and Bolivia, undertook such policies in a fiscally prudent manner, ensuring that government deficits would not lead to high debt and macroeconomic instability. On the other hand, Venezuela's aggressive redistributive transfers under Hugo Chavez and his successor Nicolas Maduro were financed by temporary oil revenues, placing both the transfers and macroeconomic stability at risk. Even though inequality has been reduced in Venezuela, for the time being, the economy's growth prospects have been severely weakened. Latin America is the only world region where inequality has declined since the early 1990s. Improved social policies and increased investment in education have been substantial factors. But the decline in pay differential between skilled and unskilled workers, what economists call the skill premium, has also played an important role. Whether this is good news or bad for economic growth depends on why the skill premium has fallen. If pay differentials have narrowed because of an increase in the relative supply of skilled workers, we can be hopeful that declining inequality in Latin America will not stand in the way of faster growth, and may even be an early indicator of it. But if the underlying cause is the decline in demand for skilled workers, smaller differentials would suggest that the modern, skill-intensive industries on which future growth depends are not expanding sufficiently. In the advanced countries, the causes of rising inequality are still being debated. Automation and other technological changes, globalization, weaker trade unions, erosion of minimum wages, financialization, and changing norms about acceptable pay gaps within enterprises have all played a role, with different weights in the United States relative to Europe. Each one of these drivers has a different effect on growth. Though technological progress clearly fosters growth, the rise of finance since the 1990s has probably had an adverse effect via financial crises and the accumulation of debt. It is good that economists no longer regard the equality-efficiency trade-off as an iron law. We should not invert the error and conclude that greater equality and better economic performance always go together. After all, there really is only one universal truth in economics. It depends. The different faces of technological innovation. We seem to be living in an accelerated age of revolutionary technological breakthroughs. Barely a day passes without the announcement of some major new development in artificial intelligence, biotechnology, digitization, or automation. Yet those who are supposed to know where it is all taking us can't make up their minds. At one end of the spectrum are the techno-optimists, who believe we are on the cusp of a new era in which the world's living standards will rise more rapidly than ever. On the other end are the techno-pessimists, who see disappointing productivity statistics and argue that the new technology's economy-wide benefits will remain limited. Then there are those, the techno-worriers, who agree with the optimists about the scale and scope of innovation, but fret about the adverse implications for employment or equity. What distinguishes these perspectives from one another is not so much disagreement about the rate of technological innovation. After all, who can seriously doubt that innovation is progressing rapidly? The debate is about whether these innovations will remain bottled up in a few tech-intensive sectors that employ the highest skilled professionals and account for a relatively small share of GDP, or spread to the bulk of the economy. The consequences of any innovation for productivity, unemployment, and equity ultimately depend on how quickly it diffuses through labor and product markets. Technological diffusion can be constrained on both the demand and supply sides of the economy. Take the demand side first. In rich economies, consumers spend the bulk of their income on services such as health, education, transportation, housing, and retail goods. Technological innovation has had comparatively little impact to date in many of these sectors. Consider some of the figures provided by the McKinsey Global Institute's report, Digital America. The two sectors in the United States that have experienced the most rapid productivity growth since 2005 are the ICT, information and communications technology, and media industries, with a combined GDP share of less than 10%. By contrast, government services and healthcare, which together produce more than a quarter of GDP, have had virtually no productivity growth. Techno-optimists, such as the McKinsey authors, look at such numbers as an opportunity. There remain vast productivity gains to be had from the adoption of new technologies in the lagging sectors. The pessimists, on the other hand, think that such gaps may be a structural, lasting feature of today's economies. For example, the economic historian Robert Gordon argues that today's innovations pale in contrast to past technological revolutions in terms of their likely economy-wide impact. Electricity, the automobile, airplane, air conditioning, and household appliances altered the way that ordinary people live in fundamental ways. They made inroads in every sector of the economy. Perhaps the digital revolution, impressive as it has been, will not reach as far. On the supply side, the key question is whether the innovating sector has access to the capital and skills it needs to expand rapidly and continuously. In advanced countries, neither constraint typically binds much. But when the technology requires high skills, technological change is skill-biased in economists' terminology, its adoption and diffusion will tend to widen the gap between the earnings of low and high-skill workers. Economic growth will be accompanied by rising inequality, as it was in the 1990s. The supply-side problem faced by developing countries is more debilitating. The labor force is predominantly low-skilled. Historically, this has not been a handicap for late industrializers, so long as manufacturing consisted of labor-intensive assembly operations, such as garments and automobiles. Peasants could be transformed into factory workers virtually overnight, implying significant productivity gains for the economy. Manufacturing was traditionally a rapid escalator to higher income levels. But once manufacturing operations become robotized and require high skills, the supply-side constraints begin to bite. Effectively, developing countries lose their comparative advantage vis-à-vis the rich countries. We see the consequences in the premature deindustrialization of the developing world today. In a world of premature deindustrialization, achieving economy-wide productivity growth becomes that much harder for low-income countries. As we saw in an earlier chapter, it is not clear whether there are effective substitutes for industrialization. The economist Tyler Cohen has suggested that developing countries may benefit from the trickle-down of innovation from the advanced economies. They can consume a stream of new products at cheap prices. This is a model of what Cohen calls cell phones instead of automobile factories. But the question remains, what will these countries produce and export, besides primary products, to be able to afford the imported cell phones? In Latin America, economy-wide productivity has stagnated despite significant innovation in the best-managed firms and vanguard sectors. The apparent paradox is resolved by noting that rapid productivity growth in the pockets of innovation has been undone by workers moving from a more productive to the less productive parts of the economy. a phenomenon that my co-authors and I have called growth-reducing structural change. This perverse outcome becomes possible when there is severe technological dualism in the economy, and the more productive activities do not expand rapidly enough. Disturbingly, there is some evidence that growth-reducing structural change has been happening recently in the United States as well. Ultimately, it is the economy-wide productivity consequences of technological innovation, not innovation per se, that lifts living standards. Innovation can coexist side by side with low productivity. Conversely, productivity growth is sometimes possible in the absence of innovation, when resources move to more productive sectors. Techno-pessimists recognize this. The optimists might not be wrong, but to make their case, they need to focus on how the effects of technology play out in the economy as a whole. In praise of Foxy scholars. We live in a complicated world, so we are forced to simplify it. We categorize people around us as friends or foes, classify their motives as good or bad, and describe events with complex roots to straightforward causes. Such shortcuts help us navigate the complexities of our social existence. They help us form expectations about the consequences of our and others' actions, and thereby facilitate decision-making. But because such mental models are simplifications, they are necessarily wrong. They may serve us well as we navigate our daily challenges, but they leave out many details and can backfire when we find ourselves in an environment in which our categorizations and ready-made explanations fit less well. The term culture shock refers to situations in which our expectations about people's behavior turn out to be so wrong that we find ourselves jolted by the experience. And yet, without these shortcuts, we would be either lost or paralyzed. We have neither the mental capacity nor the understanding to decipher the full web of cause and effect relations in our social existence. So our daily behavior and reactions must be based on incomplete and occasionally misleading mental models. The best that social science has to offer is, in fact, not much different. The social scientists, and economists in particular, analyze the world using simple conceptual frameworks that they call models. The virtue of such models is that they make explicit the chain of cause and effect, and therefore render transparent the specific assumptions on which a particular prediction rests. Good social science turns our unexamined intuitions into a map of causal arrows. Sometimes it shows how those intuitions lead to surprising, unanticipated results when extended to their logical conclusions. Fully general frameworks, such as economists' beloved Arrow de Brew model of general equilibrium, are so broad and encompassing that they are totally unhelpful for real-world explanation or prediction. Useful social science models are invariably simplifications. They leave out many details to focus on the most relevant aspect of a specific context. Applied economists' mathematical models are the most explicit example of this. But, whether formalized or not, simplified narratives are social scientists' bread and butter. Stylized historical analogies often play a similar role. For example, international relations scholars use the famous meeting between Neville Chamberlain and Adolf Hitler in Munich in 1938 as a model of how appeasing a power bent on expansionism can be futile or dangerous. But, as inevitable as simplification is for explanation, it is also a trap. It is easy to get wedded to particular models and fail to recognize that changed circumstances require a different model. Like other humans, social scientists are prone to overconfidence in their preferred model of the day. They tend to exaggerate the support for the model and discount new evidence that contradicts it, a phenomenon known as confirmation bias. In a world of diverse and changing circumstances, social scientists can do real harm by applying the wrong model. Neoliberal economic policies, predicated on well-functioning markets, misfired in developing countries, just as planning models, presuming competent and capable bureaucrats, failed in an earlier era. The efficient markets theory led policymakers astray by encouraging them to undertake excessive financial deregulation. It would be costly to apply the analogy of Munich in 1938 to a specific international conflict when the underlying situation is more reminiscent of Sarajevo in 1914. So how should we choose among alternative simplifications of reality? Rigorous empirical tests may eventually settle questions, such as whether the U.S. economy today is suffering more from Keynesian lack of demand or from policy uncertainty. Yet often we need to make decisions in real time, without the benefit of decisive empirical evidence. My research on growth diagnostics with Ricardo Hausmann, Andres Velasco, and others is an example of this style of work, showing how one can identify, in a specific context, the more binding among a multitude of growth constraints. Unfortunately, economists and other social scientists get virtually no training in how to choose among alternative models. Neither is such an aptitude professionally rewarded. Developing new theories and empirical tests is regarded as science, while the exercise of good judgment is clearly a craft. The philosopher Isaiah Berlin famously distinguished between two styles of thinking, which he identified with the hedgehog and the fox. The hedgehog is captivated by a single big idea, which he applies unremittingly. The fox, by contrast, lacks a grand vision and holds many different views about the world, some of them even contradictory. We can always anticipate the hedgehog's take on a problem, just as we can predict that market fundamentalists will always prescribe freer markets, regardless of the nature of the economic problem. Foxes carry competing, possibly incompatible, theories in their heads. They are not attached to a particular ideology, and find it easier to think contextually. In the terminology of Daniel Dresner, foxes are thought leaders, while hedgehogs are the true public intellectuals. Scholars who are able to navigate from one explanatory framework to another as circumstances require are more likely to point us in the right direction. The world needs fewer hedgehogs and more foxes. Chapter 7. Economists, Politics, and Ideas. For people who work in the world of ideas, economists are oddly silent on the role of ideas in shaping behavior and social outcomes. They emphasize interests instead, the raw selfish motive of advancing one's own standing in material, social, and political arenas. Yet without ideas about how the world works, what objectives we should pursue, and which strategies are available to pursue our ends, the concept of self-interest is empty and useless. Identities, norms, values, worldviews, opportunities, and constraints are all shaped by ideas in the air, and not just those of economists. Taking ideas seriously helps us solve many conundrums in social and political life. Why do elites block economic reform in some societies for fear that it may undermine their political power while championing it in others? Why did intellectuals and political parties on the left turn into cheerleaders for globalization, rendering them incapable of responding to the eventual backlash? What compelled America's white middle class to vote against its apparent economic self-interest in the 2016 presidential elections? Equally important, taking ideas seriously helps us escape the iron cage of vested interests as we move forward to reform our economics and politics. Economics and Political Economy. There was a time when we economists steered clear of politics. We viewed our job as describing how market economies work, when they fail, and how well-designed policies can enhance efficiency. We analyzed trade-offs between competing objectives, say, equity versus efficiency, and prescribed policies that meet desired economic outcomes, including equity. It was up to politicians to take our advice or not, and up to bureaucrats to implement it. Then some of us became more ambitious. Frustrated by the reality that much of our advice went unheeded, so many free market solutions still waiting to be taken up, we turned our analytical toolkit on the behavior of politicians and bureaucrats themselves. We began to examine political behavior using the same frameworks that we use for consumer and producer decisions in a market economy. Politicians became income-maximizing suppliers of policy favors. Citizens became rent-seeking lobbies and special interests, and political systems became marketplaces in which votes and political influence are traded for economic benefits. Thus was born the field of rational choice political economy, and a style of theorizing that many political scientists readily emulated. The apparent payoff was that we could now explain why politicians did so many things that apparently violated economic rationality. Indeed, there was no economic malfunction for which the two words vested interests could not account. Why are so many industries closed off to real competition? Because politicians are in the pockets of the incumbents who reap the rents. Why do governments erect barriers to international trade? Because the beneficiaries of trade protection are concentrated and politically influential, while consumers are diffuse and disorganized. Why do political elites block reforms that would spur economic growth and development? Because growth and development would undermine their hold on political power. Why are there financial crises? Because banks capture the policy-making process so that they can take excessive risks at the expense of the general public. In the aftermath of the financial crisis, for example, many economists laid the blame on the power of big banks. It is because politicians are beholden to financial interests, they said, that the regulatory environment allowed those interests to reap huge rewards at great social expense. The most widely held theory of politics is also the simplest. The powerful get what they want. Financial regulation is driven by the interests of banks, health policy by the interests of insurance companies, and tax policy by the interests of the rich. Those who can influence government the most through their control of resources, information, access, or sheer threat of violence eventually get their way. It's the same globally. Foreign policy is determined, it is said, first and foremost by national interests, not affinities with other nations or concern for the global economy. International agreements are impossible unless they are aligned with the interests of the United States and increasingly other rising major powers. In authoritarian regimes, policies are the direct expression of the interests of the ruler and his cronies. This is a compelling narrative, one with which we can readily explain how politics so often generates perverse outcomes. Whether in democracies, dictatorships, or in the international arena, those outcomes reflect the ability of narrow special interests to achieve results that harm the majority. In order to change the world, we need to understand it, and this mode of analysis seemed to transport us to a higher level of understanding of economic and political outcomes. But there was a deep paradox in all of this. The more we claimed to be explaining, the less room was left for improving matters. If politicians' behavior is determined by the vested interests to which they are beholden, economists' advocacy of policy reforms is bound to fall on deaf ears. The more complete our social science, the more irrelevant our policy analysis. It helps here to draw an analogy between human sciences and natural sciences, not to suggest that one is like the other, but to clarify the differences. Consider the relationship between science and engineering. As scientists' understanding of the physical laws of nature grows more sophisticated, engineers can build better bridges and buildings. Improvements in natural science enhance rather than impede our ability to shape our physical environment. The relationship between political economy and political analysis is not at all like this. By making politicians' behavior an inherent part of the model, endogenizing it in economists' jargon, political economy disempowers policy analysts. It is as if physicists came up with the theories that not only explained natural phenomena, but also determined which bridges and buildings engineers would build. There would then scarcely be any need for engineering schools. If it seems to you that something is wrong with this, you are on to something. In reality, our contemporary frameworks of political economy are replete with unstated assumptions about the system of ideas underlying the operation of our societies and political systems. Make those assumptions explicit, and the decisive role of vested interests evaporates. Policy design, political leadership, and human agency come back to life. The primacy of ideas. John Maynard Keynes once famously said that even the most practical man of affairs is usually in the thrall of the ideas of some long-dead economist. He probably didn't put it nearly strongly enough. The ideas that have produced, for example, the unbridled globalization and financial excess of the last few decades have emanated from economists who are, for the most part, very much alive. Those who chalk up the global financial crisis of 2008 to 2009 to the power of big banks conveniently overlook the legitimizing role played by economists themselves. It was economists and their ideas that made it respectable for policymakers and regulators to believe that what is good for Wall Street is good for Main Street. Ideas are not fixed or predetermined. They are themselves shaped by ideas, beliefs about who we are, what we are trying to achieve, and how the world works. Our perceptions of self-interest are always filtered through the lens of ideas. In truth, we don't have interests. We have ideas about what our interests are. Consider a struggling firm that is trying to improve its competitive position. One strategy is to lay off some workers and outsource production to cheaper locations in Asia. Alternatively, the firm can invest in skills training and build a more productive workforce with greater loyalty and hence lower turnover costs. It can compete on price or on quality. The mere fact that the firm's owners are self-interested tells us little about which of these strategies will be followed. What ultimately determines the firm's choice is a whole series of subjective evaluations of the likelihood of different scenarios alongside a calculation of their costs and benefits. Similarly, imagine that you are a despotic ruler in a poor country. What is the best way to maintain your power and preempt domestic and foreign threats? Do you build a strong, export-oriented economy? Or do you turn inward and reward your military friends and other cronies at the expense of almost everyone else? Authoritarian rulers in East Asia embraced the first strategy. Their counterparts in the Middle East opted for the second. They had different conceptions of where their interests lie. Or consider China's role in the global economy. As the People's Republic becomes a major power, its leaders will have to decide what kind of international system they want. Perhaps they will choose to build on and strengthen the existing multilateral regime, which has served them well in the past. But perhaps they will prefer bilateral, ad hoc relations that allow them to extract greater advantage in their transactions with individual countries. We cannot predict the shape that the world economy will take just from observing that China and its interests will loom larger. We could multiply such examples endlessly. Are German government's domestic political fortunes best served by stuffing austerity down Greece's throat at the cost of another debt restructuring down the line, or by easing up on its conditions, which might give Greece a chance to grow out of its debt burden? Are the U.S. interests at the World Bank best served by directly nominating an American as president, or by cooperating with other countries to select the most suitable candidate, American or not? The fact that we debate such questions passionately suggests that we all have varying conceptions of where self-interest lies. Our interests are, in fact, hostage to our ideas. So where do those ideas come from? Policymakers, like all of us, are slaves to fashion. Their perspectives on what is feasible and desirable are shaped by the zeitgeist, the ideas in the air. This means that economists and other thought leaders can exert much influence, for good or ill. Economists love theories that place organized special interests at the root of all political evil. In the real world, they cannot wriggle so easily out of responsibility for the bad ideas that they have so often spawned. With influence comes accountability. Making the role of ideas explicit. Any political economy analysis in which organized interests do not figure prominently is likely to remain vacuous and incomplete. But it does not follow from this that interests are the ultimate determinant of political outcomes. There is, in fact, no well-defined mapping from interests to outcomes. This mapping depends on many unstated assumptions about the ideas that political actors have about, one, their objectives, two, how the world works, and three, the set of tools they have at their disposal to further their interests. Importantly, these ideas are subject to both manipulation and innovation, making them part of the political game. There is, in fact, a useful analogy between inventive activity and technology, which economists now routinely make endogenous in their models, and investment in persuasion and policy innovation in the political arena. Once their fluid nature is recognized, vested interests become much less determining, and the space of possible outcomes becomes wider. While hidden assumptions play a role in all economic models, the failure to recognize the role of ideas in shaping interests and their pursuit has especially serious implications in political economy. Taking ideas into account allows us to provide a more convincing account of both stasis and change in political economic life. It provides a way of bridging the sharp divide between policy analysis, what should be done, with political economy, what actually happens. It also yields an explanation for many mysteries in the real world. Why do people support policies that do not appear to be in their interest? Why do many reforms turn out to benefit the elites who previously blocked them? Why do apparently similar groups define their interests so differently? Why do vested interests that once appeared rock solid sometimes suddenly dissipate? Let's take a look at the ways in which ideas make their way, more often than not implicitly, into established ways of thinking about political economy. Every rational choice model is built on the purposive behavior of individual decision makers. Typically, behavior is determined by assuming individuals solve what economists would call a well-defined optimization problem. At least three components must be specified in such an optimization exercise: an objective function, like a consumer utility function, a set of constraints, such as a budget constraint, and a set of choice variables, like consumption levels. Political economy models in the rational choice mold translate this framework into the political arena. Political agents, voters, lobbies, elites, congressmen, are represented as rational individuals who solve explicit optimization problems. This means they maximize a utility function defined over consumption, rents, or political benefits. They operate within constraints imposed by the rules of the game, both economic and political, and they choose a set of actions, which in various models may include votes, political contributions, rebellion, and suppression, that maximize their objection function given the constraints. For example, and in simpler terms, business lobbies decide how much they should spend in political contributions in return for tariff protection, taking into account that politicians value societal welfare alongside the contributions. Or a dictator decides whether to develop his economy so as to maximize his intertemporal stream of rents, taking into account that his decision affects both economic and political outcomes, including his longevity in power. Ideas enter this framework in several distinct ways that are rarely recognized. In fact, each of the three components of the optimization problem, preferences, constraints, and choice variables, rely on an implicit set of ideas. 1. Preferences are formed by ideas about who we are and what objectives we should pursue. 2. Constraints are shaped by our ideas of how the world works. 3. Choice variables are determined by ideas about what tools we have at our disposal. I will discuss each of these in turn later, providing examples from our present political economic predicament to illustrate them. I emphasize that I am not contesting rationality or the utility of the basic optimizing framework in the political arena. My goal is to explore the role of ideas in shaping how interests are defined and pursued, discuss economists' contributions, both good and bad, and in turn open up space for new, more useful ideas. Preferences. Who are we? Self-interest presumes the idea of a self, that is, a conception of who I am and what my purpose is. In many economic applications, the objectives we pursue are clear. It is reasonable to assume households want to maximize their consumer surplus and producers their profits, although these assumptions are not always entirely uncontroversial. In the political sphere, the choice of what is to be maximized is much less evident. Depending on context, honor, glory, reputation, respect, income, power, durability in office, and good of the country are all plausible. As John Elster has written in a critique of rational political economy frameworks attempting to explain historical political developments, the nobility in 17th century France may have been interested in honor and glory as much as in material benefits. Much human behavior is driven by abstract ideals, sacred values, or conceptions of loyalty that cannot be reduced to economic ends. Studies by anthropologists and psychologists suggest humans will kill and die not only to protect their own lives or defend kin and kith, but for an idea, the moral conception they form of themselves, of who we are, a point that should not be controversial in an age of suicide bombings. How we evaluate different social states and judge whether they advance our interests depends crucially on how we define ourselves. We might view ourselves as a member of a social class, middle class, ethnic group, white majority, religion, evangelical, nation, global citizen, demographic cohort, baby boomer, profession, educator, or a myriad of other possible identities. As Amartya Sen has suggested, we might even combine all these identities in varying degrees. In political science, a well-established line of research has long held that interests of political actors are socially constructed rather than determined by well-defined material facts. In this constructivist tradition, conceptions of interest arise endogenously from norms, ideologies, and causal beliefs. Interests, in fact, are one form of idea. In international law, a parallel discussion pits legal realists who argue that behavior among states is determined exclusively or largely by national interests against scholars who see a significant role for norms of justice or law. Economists have rarely ventured as far as some of these other disciplines in acknowledging the nuances of self-interest and identity. But the role of ideas in determining preferences has crept into various strands of research in economics. For example, the partisan politics literature in macroeconomics endows political parties with explicit ideologies, typically represented as different preference weights on inflation versus unemployment. These differences in preferences are typically imposed from outside the model, with little explanation. More recently, there has been some work, both at the macro and micro levels, that looks at how ideologies are shaped and develop. These studies examine the formation of political preferences through exposure to societal outcomes, media, or early childhood experiences. The work of George Akerlof and Rachel Cranton on the economics of identity is particularly relevant here. Akerlof and Cranton consider models where individuals associate themselves with specific social categories and their desired behavior derives from the attributes of those categories. Workers, for example, may acquire identities that moderate the incentive compatibility constraint vis-à-vis their employers, leading them to behave in greater conformity with the objectives of their firms. In turn, employers may seek to alter such identities to enhance workplace performance. Such models could explain a range of anomalous political action, including voting against immediate material interests. But the possible application of this approach to political phenomena has not yet received much attention. In each of these frameworks, ideas play a crucial role. Instead of remaining implicit or a sideshow, they determine preferences directly and therefore shape patterns of political behavior. This perspective requires social scientists to engage with the questions of where ideas come from and how they are spread and internalized. Interests are shaped by identity, and identities are shaped in turn by our social and political interactions. Successful political leaders know that identities can be molded for political ends. Consider how the wealthy in the United States have been spared a popular revolt against inequality, despite the vast increase in income concentration in recent decades. How the rich rule. It is hardly news that the rich have more political power than the poor, even in democratic countries where everyone gets a single vote in elections. But two political scientists, Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page, have recently produced some stark findings for the United States that have dramatic implications for the functioning of democracy in the United States and elsewhere. The author's research builds on prior work by Gillens, who painstakingly collected public opinion polls on nearly 2,000 policy questions from 1981 to 2002. The pair then examined whether America's federal government adopted the policy in question within 4 years of the survey, and tracked how closely the outcome matched the preferences of voters at different points of the income distribution. When viewed in isolation, the preferences of the average voter, that is, a voter in the middle of the income distribution, seemed to have a strongly positive influence on the government's ultimate response. A policy that the average voter would like is significantly more likely to be enacted. But as Gillens and Page note, this gives a misleadingly upbeat impression of the representativeness of government decisions. The preferences of the average voter and of economic elites are not very different on most policy matters. For example, both groups of voters would like to see a strong national defense and a healthy economy. A better test would be to examine what the government does when the two groups have divergent views. To carry out that test, Gillens and Page ran a horse race between the preferences of average voters and those of economic elites, defined as individuals at the top 10th percentile of the income distribution, to see which voters exert greater influence. They found that the effect of the average voter drops to insignificant levels, while that of economic elites remains substantial. The implication is clear. When the elite's interests differ from those of the rest of society, it is their views that count, almost exclusively. As Gillens and Page explain, we should think of the preferences of the top 10% as a proxy for the views of the truly wealthy, say the top 1%, the genuine elite. Gillens and Page report similar results for organized interest groups, which wield a powerful influence on policy formation. As they point out, it makes very little difference what the general public thinks once interest group alignments and the preferences of affluent Americans are taken into account. These disheartening results raise an important question. How do politicians who are unresponsive to the preferences of the vast majority of their constituents get elected and, more importantly, re-elected while doing the bidding mostly of the wealthiest individuals? Part of the explanation may be that most voters have a poor understanding of how the political system works and how it is tilted in favor of the economic elite. As Gillens and Page emphasize, their evidence does not imply that government policy makes the average citizen worse off. Ordinary citizens often do get what they want by virtue of the fact that their preferences frequently are similar to those of the elite. This correlation of the two groups' preferences may make it difficult for voters to discern politicians' bias. But another, more pernicious part of the answer may lie in the strategies to which political leaders resort in order to get elected. A politician who represents the interests primarily of economic elites must find other means of appealing to the masses. Such alternatives are provided by the politics of nationalism, sectarianism, and identity. A politics based on cultural values and symbolism rather than bread-and-butter interests. When politics is waged on these grounds, elections are won by those who are most successful at priming our latent cultural and psychological markers, not those who best represent our economic interests. Karl Marx famously said that religion is the opium of the people. What he meant is that religious sentiment could obscure the material deprivations that workers and other exploited people experience in their daily lives. In much the same way, the rise of the religious right, and with it culture wars over family values and other highly polarizing issues, for example, immigration, have served to insulate American politics from the sharp rise in economic inequality since the late 1970s. Right-wing media outlets and think tanks have spun tales that led voters with stagnating incomes to attribute their hardship to minorities, African Americans, immigrants, women on welfare, that the government has supposedly favored over them. As a result, conservatives have been able to retain power despite their pursuit of economic and social policies that are inimical to the interests of the middle and lower classes. As I discussed in Chapter 4, in the context of developing nations, identity politics is malignant because it tends to draw boundaries around a privileged in-group and requires the exclusion of outsiders, those of other countries, values, religions, or ethnicities. This can be seen most clearly in illiberal democracies such as Russia, Turkey, and Hungary. In order to solidify their electoral base, leaders in these countries appeal heavily to national, cultural, and religious symbols. In doing so, they typically inflame passions against religious and ethnic minorities. For regimes that represent economic elites and are often corrupt to the core, it is a ploy that pays off handsomely at the polls. Widening inequality in the world's advanced and developing countries thus inflicts two blows against democratic politics. Not only does it lead to greater disenfranchisement of the middle and lower classes, but it also fosters among the elite a poisonous politics of sectarianism. Constraints. Models of how the world works. Let's turn next to the second set of ideas that enter the optimization problem outlined at the beginning of this chapter. Ideas about how the world works. Investors, consumers, workers, and policymakers all operate under certain working assumptions about causal relationships around them. Their worldviews shape their perception of the consequences of their and others' actions in both economic and political domains. These ideas may fall on either side of some of the biggest controversies in the history of economic thought. Does the economy work better under laissez-faire or planning? Are economic growth and development more rapid under free trade or under protection? Does macroeconomic stability require Keynesian counter-cyclical policies or Hayekian non-intervention? Each of these positions presumes a particular model of how the economy works, and therefore has different implications for political behavior. In recent decades, a succession of economic ideas, think of Keynesianism, monetarism, rational expectations, and the Washington Consensus, have served to change both elites' and non-elites' understanding of economic reality, and thereby altered the political equilibrium. A rent-extracting autocrat is likely to tax his subjects to the hilt when he believes they have little choice but to pay up. The same autocrat will be more restrained when he believes subjects can evade the tax or mount an effective opposition. Which of these two models is the correct one? Elasticity pessimism, the belief that economic activities tend to be unresponsive to prices, lay behind the widespread consensus in support of the dirigiste economic development policies of the 1950s and 1960s. Pratap Mehta and Michael Walton describe the Nehruvian cognitive map that shaped India's development path in the decades following independence, the need for a big investment push, suspicions over the private sector, emphasis on the leading role of capital goods, and export pessimism, the fear that expansion of exports will run against serious limits, all derived from ideas about how a market system worked or failed to do so. As research demonstrated that the poor were as responsive to price incentives as the rich, policies in the developing world began to move in a more market-oriented direction. Economics is all about sharpening our ideas about the right model in the relevant context, a point on which I will elaborate later. Yet actors in our political economy frameworks live in worlds where these questions have been effectively resolved. They believe that they know how the world works, if not precisely, at least probabilistically. Even if they disagreed for a time, adherents of this view argue agents would eventually reach agreement on the right model as events and reactions to policy choices unfold. In practice, however, people often downplay evidence that seems inconsistent with their model of the world. Anomalous outcomes are dismissed as a fluke or as the result of insufficiently vigorous application of their preferred policy. Individuals with different prior beliefs may draw sharply different conclusions from the same piece of news. Observing a sudden rise in unemployment, a Keynesian might strengthen his belief that monetary policy is too tight, while a monetarist might infer monetary policy is even looser than he thought and is discouraging employment creation by generating expectations of future inflation. Furthermore, even if all actors are rational and perfectly calculating, beliefs about the true model need not converge when there is sufficient variability in the external environment. A more realistic representation may be that cognitive and other limitations force political agents to live in a world of deep uncertainty with respect to their understanding of causal relationships. Their view of the world could be wrong and could remain so even in the face of new evidence if that evidence is just used to confirm past beliefs. Conversely, new information may present realities previously not considered. For instance, voters may discover that an office holder has a long criminal track record, a possibility that may not have entered their calculus earlier. An interesting new empirical literature has begun to document how the provision of such information can influence voters' behavior. Consider the experience of the global economic and financial crisis in recent years, and the extent to which it has altered beliefs. Many observers, such as Simon Johnson and James Kwok, have argued that the policies that produced the crisis were the result of powerful banking and financial interests getting their way, which seems like a straightforward application of the theory of special interests. Still, without the wave of ideas in the air that favored financial liberalization and self-regulation and emphasized the impossibility or undesirability of government regulation, these vested interests would not have gotten nearly as much traction as they did. After all, powerful interests rarely get their way in a democracy by nakedly arguing for their own self-interest. Instead, they seek legitimacy for their arguments by saying these policies are in the public interest. The argument in favor of financial deregulation was not that it was good for Wall Street, but that it was good for Main Street. Other observers have argued that the financial crisis was a result of excessive government intervention to support housing markets, especially for lower-income borrowers. These arguments were also grounded on certain ideas about the social value of homeownership and the inattentiveness of the financial sector to those with lower incomes. Charles Calamiris and Stephen Haber suggest that it was the alliance between banking interests and community groups, the latter seeking to increase homeownership among low-income groups, which played the critical role. Again, ideas apparently shaped these groups' and politicians' views of how the world works, and therefore their interest in acting in ways that precipitated the crisis. Had community groups been more attentive to the problems of indebtedness, they may have been less interested in expanding home ownership among the poor. Finally, although all parties have observed the same Great Recession taking place, relatively few have altered their fundamental beliefs about whether the financial sector is over- or under-regulated as a result. A class of its own. The very rich, F. Scott Fitzgerald famously wrote, are different from you and me. Their wealth makes them cynical where we are trustful, and makes them think they are better than we are. If these words ring true today, perhaps it is because when they were written, in 1926, inequality in the United States had reached heights comparable to today. We have heard before how the rich and the political elite can manipulate group identities to shape non-elites' political preferences. But where do the rich get their ideas about what is in their own best interest? When inequality in the advanced countries was more moderate, the gap between the super-rich and the rest of society seemed less colossal, not just in terms of income and wealth, but also in terms of attachments and social purpose. The rich had more money, of course, but they somehow still seemed part of the same society as the poor, recognizing that geography and citizenship made them share a common fate. Their mental map of how the world works made them take a broader interest in society. Mark Mizrucci has shown how the American corporate elite in the post-war era had an ethic of civic responsibility and enlightened self-interest. They cooperated with trade unions and favored a strong government role in regulating and stabilizing markets. They understood the need for taxes to pay for important public goods such as the interstate highway and safety nets for the poor and elderly. Business elites were not any less politically powerful back then, but they used their influence to advance an agenda that was broadly in the national interest. By contrast, today's super-rich are moaning moguls, to use James Surowiecki's evocative term. Exhibit A for Surowiecki is Stephen Schwarzman, the chairman and CEO of the private equity firm The Blackstone Group, whose wealth exceeds $10 billion. Schwarzman acts as if he's beset by a meddlesome, tax-happy government and a whiny, envious populace. He has suggested that it might be good to raise income taxes on the poor so they had skin in the game, and that proposals to repeal the carried interest tax loophole, from which he personally benefits, were akin to the German invasion of Poland. Other examples from Surowiecki. The venture capitalist Tom Perkins and Kenneth Langone, the co-founder of Home Depot, both compared populist attacks on the wealthy to the Nazis' attacks on the Jews. Surowiecki thinks that the change in attitudes has much to do with globalization. Large American corporations and banks now roam the globe freely and are no longer so dependent on the U.S. consumer. Their ideas about how the world works has changed radically. The health of the American middle class is of little interest to them these days. Moreover, Surowiecki argues, socialism has gone by the wayside, and there is no need to co-op